First off, I think I'd like to hear something about your background, where you grew up, and your education, and so forth, prior to going to work at the University Club.
Well, I was born in Red Oak, Iowa, and I stayed there 10 years, and then we moved to Sheraton. My father was a traveling man. He was always going places. And so I graduated from high school then, and I went out to the state of New York and worked in a newspaper office for a couple of years.
Why New York?
I had an aunt and uncle out there. My uncle was a minister, and he wanted me to come out for a vacation. I went out to stay 2 weeks, and I stayed 2 years. That was the reason I stayed there all that time. And I went back to Iowa, and my father was transferred to Madison, Wisconsin. And so I went with him. And wasn't possible for me to go to school at that time, so I got a job at the Packard Motors as a bookkeeper, secretary.
Where were they located?
On 515 University Avenue, which is now the International Pancake House down that way.
Oh, that corner, sort of.
A corner, sort of, yes. And they went bankrupt, and so I had to look for a job. And the person who was in charge said he knew that Dora Bush, who was manager of the University Club, was looking for a receptionist. And he wanted me to see her very badly. And so I said, well, I'll go over and talk to her, but I'm going away this weekend. Now, when do you want me to see her? And he says, you call her and tell her when you're coming back. And I told her, I called her, and I said, told her who I was, and I said, I heard you had a job open as a receptionist, and I would be interested, but I'm leaving town, and I'll be back Sunday night at 11 o'clock. And I went over there, and she saw me then.
Sunday night?
Sunday night.
At 11 o'clock?
11 o'clock. She says, when can you start? And I said, well, how soon would you want me? And she said, tomorrow, because it was the beginning of registration. And so
A busy time.
And so when I came over there, she said, can you start in the morning? And I said, no, I can't start in the morning because I have promised to somebody else I would start working for them. But I said, this sounds so interesting that I'd like to come work for you. And so I walked the street most of the night wondering how I was going to tell this other company that I wasn't going
what
to
was,
be there.
What was the other company?
The Hebe Company. It was an automotive parts. They're not in existence anymore. Down on Gorham or Gilman or someplace like that. All these history. And so I went over there and they told me to take off my hat and coat. And I said, well, but I'm not staying. I said, I have another job. And so I went downtown, had my hair done, went over to the club noon on Monday.
This would have been
In the fall, in September, about the 16th or 17th, 14th, something like that.
So that's how it all began.
That's how it all began. And she had asked me the night before if I would stay a year because she didn't want to break in somebody all the time. And I said, yes, I will stay at least a year. And the year went into 46 years.
My goodness. How long were you a receptionist?
Well, I was a receptionist, but I was at the desk and started to taking on more duties all the time. We got a new manager 2 years later, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, really not much. There isn't an awful lot to do here. He said, this is ridiculous. You can do a lot more than that. So the first thing he had me do, I started taking over the renting of the rooms. We had 100 rooms for 100 people. And I took that over first.
Well, you couldn't have had 100 rooms. Or these must have been doubled up some way.
There were, there were I think 14 double rooms. So how many would that be? So we housed 102 people when everything was filled. Uh-huh. And then they just added, I did a lot of typing and...
correspondence, record keeping.
Correspondence and some record keeping. We had a bookkeeper. And let's see. Started taking reservations for parties, dinners.
Things like that.
Yeah.
What had you been doing before?
I think answering the telephones and taking messages and a few things like that. Not too much.
Certainly doesn't sound strenuous.
But I've always been a workaholic, and I just sort of ate up all this responsibility that just kept being added to me. At that time, we had a manager who was more interested in doing some of the little things around there, like plumbing and fixing electricity and all that sort of stuff, and so he just left a lot of it to me. Because I like to meet the public, and he didn't.
I see. So he looked after maintaining the place more.
Oh, yes, at that time. He didn't have to, but it saved a lot of money, because they didn't have very much money ever. They don't now, either.
That I'm aware of. What was his name?
Ed Thomas.
Ed Thomas. Tell me what the club was like in terms of, what the building was like. Was it like it is now? And what activities went on there when you first went?
They always had a big social program. They told me that the club was the hub of the social life of the university. I think probably the faculty was about 2,500 people. And it was a very, very exclusive place.
Oh.
You couldn't come in there unless you were a member or meeting or being a guest of a member, unless you were there to a party to which you had been invited. You had to be a member. If you were in the dining room, you had to sign for your meals. They wouldn't accept cash in the dining room. Noontime, you had to have a coat and tie on. And, of course, in the evening, you had to have a coat and tie. They had a host or a hostess and waiters. They had a lovely silver china.
No, real silver?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was sterling, but it was... probably community silver. It was very nice. It was rather formal. Nothing much happened in the dining room. You kept your voices low. Women couldn't sit up in the front part of the dining room unless it was a party. Occasionally, if they were meeting a gentleman, then they could go up there and sit in the front part of the dining room. Otherwise, they had a little partition that was just about a quarter of a way across the back of the dining room where the women could sit if they were alone. The women couldn't come in the front door. I think this happened about 1933, when women were permitted to use the front door. Never until the last few years would they be permitted to go into the men's reading room and sit down and read, unless it was a evening party, so when that was being used. But a woman would go in there and sit down, and immediately there would be several of the men jump up and go out to the desk and say, "Get that woman out of there."
My gracious. I think I was guilty of that, but perhaps it was after the rule was changed.
Yes. And they had to use the side entrance, the Murray Street entrance. And I know that for many, many years after that, in the latter years that I was there, lots of these older women would not come in the front door.
I'm surprised at this. I would have thought they'd be anxious to.
No, some of the, especially the professors' wives, maybe the professors didn't want them to come in. Who knows? The cloakroom right across from the desk was for men. When they opened it up to the university community around 1970, the men were very disturbed when a woman would put her hat or coat in their room. They had a lovely lounge over there, and they said, "We'll take it over if they don't use the one they're supposed to use."
So the men would take it over?
Mm-hmm. They said they would if the women insisted on it. I made a few enemies down there because I asked them at first if they would use the other room because they had a much bigger room. And if you get 200 coats and rubbers and raincoats of the other in the men's room, there wasn't enough room for the women to powder their nose and stuff.
Well, the women's lounge, as I've seen it, is a very pleasant room.
It's lovely.
Mm-hmm. Were there, you talked about the dining room, did they serve all three meals each day?
Yes, they generally served breakfast downstairs in a small dining room, and then they served lunch and dinner. When I first came there, they were serving dinner on Sunday. And
would that have been in midday?
Mm-hmm, midday. Mm-hmm. But I think it was around, I'm sure it was before World War II that they cut out the breakfast. And a few years afterwards, they weren't getting it. I suppose about 1960, maybe towards 1969, 70, when they were having all the upheaval down there, they weren't serving dinners.
Is that when they stopped?
Just around that time, because there wasn't enough business. People were afraid to come down there with the rioting. And
Just avoiding the center of the campus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was a big turn around in our social life down there. We would schedule dinners and people wouldn't come out to it, so we had to cancel several dinners, and then we weren't even having parties, big dinner parties, like we used to after that.
Well, tell me about these dinner parties that you used to have.
Well, we had dinner lectures where we would have sometimes a lecturer from out of town if he was a visiting professor, and we would have dinner musicals. Generally had somebody from the university give musicals. And we would take up to 200 reservations, and sometimes we opened them up on a certain day at a certain time. We'd sent notices out, and sometimes these reservations were filled within 10 minutes. Couldn't take any more.
Gracious.
And people generally dressed, especially when they had a musical. The women would wear long dresses. Sometimes the men would wear tuxedos or dark business suits. And then we had dinner dances, where it was all formal. And never had a bar, because we weren't permitted to have it was a private club, and we didn't ever want to have a liquor license at that time, or maybe we couldn't have. But they always brought their own liquor, and we would provide the setups for it. And they were really something, these dances were. And then they would open up the dining room and the reading room. We didn't have carpeting down there, so we could have the dances.
Oh, but you had carpeting that you took up, or you just didn't have any?
We didn't have any. We didn't have any in the dining room proper until in the 60s, I think it was. We just used a terrazzo floor. No, I don't mean in the dining room. I mean in the reading room.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And then we put carpeting down, or mm-hmm, a rug down. And we had women's discussion groups at noon once a month. just for the women to have, to come for lunch and then have a speaker. They were very, very popular. And had a children's party every Christmas, which was so exciting. We always had a program for them, or
these would be faculty children?
Faculty children, uh-huh. Magicians to entertain, or a movie or something like that. And they were very popular until television came in with all the children's programs, and we couldn't do anything that would entertain them that much.
Oh, dear.
So, and the people who were on committees to do the children's party sort of got tired of it, I guess, or maybe all their children grew up. And,
my goodness. Well, how long were you a receptionist?
Well, I was a receptionist, but I was at the desk and started to taking on more duties all the time. We got a new manager 2 years later, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, really not much. There isn't an awful lot to do here." He said, "This is ridiculous. You can do a lot more than that." So the first thing he had me do, I started taking over the renting of the rooms. We had 100 rooms for 100 people, and I took that over first.
Well, you couldn't have had 100 rooms. Were these must have been doubled up some way.
There were, there were, I think, 14 double rooms. So how many would that make? So we housed 102 people when everything was filled. And then they just added, I did a lot of typing and
correspondence, record keeping.
Correspondence and some record keeping. We had a bookkeeper. And started taking reservations for parties, dinners,
things like that.
Yeah.
Well, what had you been doing before?
I think answering the telephones and taking messages and a few things like that. Not too much.
Certainly doesn't sound strenuous.
But I've always been a workaholic, and I just sort of ate up all this responsibility that just kept being added to me. And at that time, we had a manager who was more interested in doing some of the little things around there, like plumbing and fixing electricity and all that sort of stuff. And so he just left a lot of it to me, because I like to meet the public, and he didn't.
I see. So he looked after maintaining the place more.
Oh, yes, at that time. He didn't have to, but it saved a lot of money, because they didn't have very much money ever. They don't now, either.
That I'm aware of. What was his name?
Ed Thomas.
Ed Thomas. Tell me what the club was like in terms of... Well, what the building was like, was it like it is now, and what activities went on there when you first went?
We didn't have carpeting down there, so we should have it. Oh, like you had carpeting that you took up, or you just didn't have it? We didn't have any in the dining room proper until in the 60s, I think it was. We just used it to raise the floor. No, I don't mean in the dining room, I mean in the reading room. I see. And then we put carpeting down, or rug down. And we had women's discussion groups at noon once a month, just for the women to come for lunch and then have a speaker. They were very, very popular. And had a children's party every Christmas, which was so exciting. We always had a program for them, or
these would be faculty children?
Magicians to entertain, or a movie or something like that. And they were very popular until television came in with all the children's programs, and we couldn't do anything that would entertain them that much.
Okay.
So, and then people who were on committees to do the children's party sort of got tired of it, I guess, or maybe all their children grew up.
For many years, there was a matrix dinner in the spring of the year over at the Wisconsin Union, where women were invited from both the university and from the town, was a town and gown affair, and it was an invitation affair to be invited. So one night, the men at the club decided they'd have a dinner, a Patrick's dinner. And so the husbands of many of the women were invited, especially the faculty people. I guess it turned out to be quite a disaster because there were so many stories told that it turned out to be a very sad affair, and I don't think they had another one after that. They might have had one, but it didn't turn out as well. But this other one was so bad that nobody wanted to come back to it.
Can you give me some examples of the problem?
I think they were the kind of stories they told that were so off color that some of our very staid professors were terribly upset about it. Uh-huh. And wouldn't go to anything like that again. I haven't heard if there was any other kind of entertainment. Maybe there was, but I hadn't heard of it. But that was a big problem with some of our people who thought the university club was a very dignified place and shouldn't have anything like that there.
Well, in the earlier days, about how high was the membership?
When I came down there, it was about 600 people. And at that time, they were paying dues 0.75% of their 10-month salary. So in those days, people were getting maybe $10,000 a year, they might have been paying $72 or $75 or something like that for membership. In 1933, when I came there, that was an awfully lot of money to be paying for dues. And I don't think the dues are much more now.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if this policy has changed or to a flat rate for everyone?
When I left there, they were paying according to their rank, whether they were a full professor, associate, assistant professor, or an instructor. And at that time, 1979, the maximum was $60 a year, plus tax. And then they were giving, because they had opened it up to the university community without dues for lunch,
mm-hmm.
they were giving the faculty people who were paying dues a certain percentage of their meals.
For lunch.
For lunch.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, who can belong to the university club?
Anybody who is a college graduate. Doesn't have to be the University of Wisconsin. Can be any college graduate.
I see.
And he can, years ago he had to be sponsored. I don't know if they have to be sponsored by anybody now. A person who might have been in business and who did not have a college degree, if he was sponsored by two members in good standing, he could belong to the club if he was passed upon by the board of directors. Everyone who has come into the club has been passed on by the board of directors. And I don't know if there's anybody been blackballed. I can't remember anybody being blackballed.
What kind of proof do you have to show to prove you're a college graduate?
Well, you really don't have that kind of proof. I suppose somebody wanted to belong very, very much and came in and signed a card, well, I graduated from Cornell in such and such a year, they probably would accept it. But I got in a conversation with some of the people who had been there and was checking up on who was still there and everything, and might have found out. I don't think anything would have happened. But this was, as I say, it was very exclusive.
So the people who are non-members at lunch now, they just pay for it.
That's right. Uh-huh. I suppose anybody could come down from downtown and go in there and have lunch and nothing would be said about it. But we used to check, and even there were many years that a person could not bring the same guest down more than twice in a semester.
Now, why was that?
Because we had a lot of business, for one thing, and they were trying to keep it rather that way. If someone took a friend down every day for lunch and he would be eligible for membership and didn't want to join, they didn't think it was fair.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. Because somebody would be signing for him. And, but then, I think it was about in the 1960s, there's such a trend against anything that was old-fashioned, or I don't know if that's exactly the word to say. It was just not the thing to do to belong to some of these establishments. And the younger people weren't very happy about it because there wasn't a bar down there and there wasn't too much excitement going on. But I really believe that in the days up until that time, there was more university policy made over the tables at lunchtime than there were in committee meetings on the... Just seemed like everybody came. And the nicest part about it was because the university was small. You'd go into the club and you would sit down and eat with a professor of English, professor of history, physics. There might be three or four different professors, and you get such a broadened education rather than when the people come in from all one department and talk about their work all the time.
Well, I understand a lot of the younger faculty take what they call brown bag lunches very often.
That's right. I think that's for economy reasons.
I wouldn't be surprised.
And, of course, we didn't permit people to come in with brown bag lunches. Even in the 70s, there were committee meetings and departmental meetings for lunch. And some of the people would bring in brown bags, and it was really frowned upon. They probably couldn't afford it. But after all, the club was in the business to try to make some money, and if people would come in with brown bags and didn't buy anything, we'd set up the tables for them. We'd have to have somebody pour their coffee, and there were dishes to be washed and everything, all the expenses, and we just weren't coming out on it.
Tell me something about the people who used your rooms, your 100 rooms, or your 102 people,
102 beds. We had no one could live there unless he was a graduate student, and he had to apply for a room, and he also would be passed upon by the board of directors. Everybody who moved into the club had to be a member. A graduate student at that time would pay $10 a year. And he had to fill out a membership blank, and he had to be sponsored by a faculty person. And we very seldom had any trouble with people coming in. Once in a while, somebody would not be very quiet or might have some problems, and occasionally a person was asked to leave.
What would be the grounds for that?
Well, of course, he might be asked to leave if he hadn't paid his room rent, for one thing. And before I came, there were lots of people who were running very high bills. Their names would be posted on the bulletin board. They would often be sent to a lawyer for collection, but sometimes it didn't happen. But they were dismissed from the club and couldn't use the club unless they paid up their back bills. And some of them were professors too.
How shameful.
But we had a few university faculty people who were bachelors who lived there. A lot of them.
Did they live there for extended periods of time?
Yes, In fact, there was one man who lived there. He was connected with the Forest Products, and he lived there for 43 years before he died.
My goodness, who was that?
Stanley Martin.
My gracious.
And Paul Jones lived down there a good long time. He was professor of music. And there was Ted Bennett in math. Let's see who else lived there. There were lots of faculty people who lived there from time to time. They had single rooms and double rooms, but most of the people lived in single rooms. And there were very few private baths. They used a community bath on the floor. So maybe eight people would use the same unit.
But it would be fairly sizable, right? So.
Yes, about three or four units of showers and voice bowls and things of that sort. There were
sort of dormitory style.
That's all they were dormitory style. After I can't remember, maybe it was in the 40s, where we had telephones in every room, but before that time they had hall telephones, unless they put in their own telephone. They had hall telephones, and they'd have one ring or two rings or three rings, and they'd go out in the hallway and answer the phone. Women were not supposed to be up on the floors at all.
Oh, only men stayed there?
Only men stayed there because of the bathroom facilities.
Oh, I see, yes.
In those days, you wouldn't.
It didn't have integrated bathrooms.
No,
right.
You didn't use them. But no, these were strictly for men, and
but women weren't allowed upstairs.
Women weren't. No, I suppose that many times a woman would sneak up the back way, but that was forbidden, really. I think there were a number of people who had them up in their rooms, but that's the way the world is.
Yes. What were the housekeeping arrangements for these rooms?
We had maids who cleaned their rooms, made up the beds every day. We provided the linens, the towels, the blankets. And a maid went into each resident's room every day, even on Sunday, until probably in the 60s, and then it was too hard to get maids for what we could pay them, and so we dropped the maid service on Sunday, and then we dropped it on Saturday, so that they had to, if they wanted their rooms cleaned or their beds made, they'd have to do it themselves. Now I think they have, when I left there, they had eight rooms where men were staying. And the reason for that was can you shut that off?
So weekends, and they had to fend for themselves.
They had to fend for themselves. But to go back in history a little bit, when I came there in 1933, I understand that the club was going through some serious financial problems. Their city taxes were very, very high. The club had been put up by private funds, by a lot of professors putting in $100, $500 to build it. And 1933, they asked the Board of Regents at the university if the building could be given to the university, because there was no way that the university could keep up paying the high city taxes. I think the regents were very reluctant to do so, but they did, and they gave the university club permission to use it until they needed it. Then in the 1960s, the chancellor thought that because there was so much need for office space, that the university club should get out of the dormitory business. And it was at the time of the unrest and rioting on the campus. And we asked if they would permit us to keep one wing of 8 rooms, not only for security reasons. We thought if somebody was in the building all night, it would be better. And because there were a number of people who had lived there many, many years. This man I talked about had been there almost 40 years, and it would be very difficult for him to move. And so this is, they said yes until they needed it. So at that time they asked us to give up the fourth floor, the third floor, and part of the second. The other part wing was where we were going to have the rooms. And then we kept, and part of the first they asked for. And then we kept the dining room, the reading room, the lobby part, and the ladies' room in the downstairs, the kitchen, the billiard room, and the ladies' lounge in the back, which was a meeting room where women used to play a lot of bridge. So they let us keep that until they decided if they would ever take it all over, but they haven't as yet. There's been too much feeling about it because it is a landmark. There's a lot of history in it. Perhaps when all of the older people who have been there 30, 40, 50 years have all gone, maybe they will take it over. I don't know. But it's, it has a wonderful heritage. There's just so many wonderful things have taken place in there. I wish the walls could talk, because we'd have a bestseller, I think.
Can you tell me about some of them?
Oh, I don't think so. No, I don't think we could tell too much about, but I mean, there were just a lot of intimate things going on all the time over there. Let's see what else I think I should tell.
Well, while you're talking about the university taking over office space, I know there's no connection between the front section, what I assume is the front section, and the back Murray Street part where there's another entrance.
Mm-hmm.
Are these two parts connected on some floors?
Yes, they're connected on the first floor. You can go in the front door or the side first Murray Street door and go right back around the hallway and go right back to the first floor. Go up the stairway on the second floor and you can go to the back of the Murray Street, or vice versa. You can also on the third, but you can't on the fourth, because on the fourth, on the new side, was an attic, and that was closed off. So if you went to the fourth floor to one of the rooms in the rear, you'd have to go across on one of the other floors or else up the back way. But about 4 years ago, after the offices were up there, they opened up this space so that they have a little throughway. So you can go up to fourth floor and get through to fourth floor in the back.
Well, I would have to investigate that, because when the oral history office, my office, was up there for 8 months, there was no connection between, and I've only heard rumors that they had opened it up.
Uh-huh.
I'll be interested to go and have a look at it now.
It's much different up there now. We had a big attic because we always stored trunks and suitcases for the people who lived in the rooms because there wasn't room for them. And we had to get rid of everything. Of course, we had that was a storage space for our extra beds and extra dressers and everything like that. So we had to give up a lot of space then, too.
Now, didn't you say they were putting an elevator in?
They're putting an elevator. They had an elevator shaft put in when the building was built.
Oh.
But they couldn't afford to put in an elevator. So in all these years, they have not had an elevator.
But they had the shaft.
But they've had the shaft.
Where was that?
And the shaft is just past the reception desk, a little bit to your left. Just before you get to the middle stairway. And we had a floor put on it on the first floor. We had that as a little storeroom, but I also did the bookkeeping in there for a few years. I strung a light up from the hallway into there, and there was no window. It was just like about 6 feet by 6 feet, and there was no heat in there, no air, but it wasn't very feasible for, after we got a machine, to do the bookkeeping because it was so noisy, and so I did it back there.
Oh.
And I think you could climb up there through a ladder up to the roof.
Up the elevator shaft?
From the second or third floor you could, up the elevator shaft, and go up on the roof part. I don't think very many people have been up there, but the shaft has always been there. I don't know how good it will be for an elevator, but they'll have to be sure that it's safe.
That should help them. They had to knock down a lot of wall in the Red Gym in order to put an elevator in.
And I don't know what it's going to do to them, and I don't know what the walls are because they're going. It has an employee's restroom on one side, and it's got a hallway in front of it and a hallway to the side of it, so I don't know how much of the space it's going to have to take up.
Well, it'd be fun to go see. Tell me something about the board of directors. How many people were on it?
I think there were generally 10 or 12 people on the board of directors, and I don't believe they were elected every year. There were always some of them elected every year. They were elected by the membership, and then the board would appoint their own officers. They had a secretary and a president. And they met generally once a month during the school year. And they were the policy-making group. They had many, many committees appointed for all of the social events that we had. We had also a house resident committee who would hear complaints from the residents or hear complaints from the employees and try to solve them. And they had committee, billiard committee, the house committee, yes. And then they had different committee chairmen for the dinner dances and all the social events and things of that sort every year.
Were there any general meetings of the membership? You said the membership elected the committee.
They were elected by mail.
I see.
There was supposed to be a general membership meeting once a year. It was in the Constitution, but many times it didn't take place. not enough people were interested in coming out to another meeting. But we generally sent out calendars every month to tell them of what was going on at the club every month.
Special events,
you mean? Special events and things like that, or any other information. So we used to have quite a lot of mailings go out, but I don't think anyone has any anymore, and I don't think there were many records kept. I think many years ago there were records up in the attic that were put up there, and something has happened to them because when we made all these changes, I was up there and I couldn't find very many records. There were some financial records of, and records, there are records of all the memberships that have been for many, many years. But as far as I know, there aren't very many other records.
Are those records still up in the attic?
I don't think so. They should be downstairs in a little, they were downstairs in a closet, and I don't know what became of the things that were in there. But they had to take a closet to put in a ramp for the use of the handicapped people. And that was just about 5 years or 4 years ago. But they were all down there at that time. We never destroyed, since I've been there, never destroyed a membership card. And we used to refer to them a lot. The FBI used to come down and inquire about people who had lived there maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. And
they do this regularly?
Whenever they needed to. Somebody had a government job or they wanted to check up on somebody. And probably because I had been there so long, I could recall many of these people. Even recall the rooms that they lived in without checking on them. And so it was a great source of information because it gave the name and the address of where these people were from.
To you, going back a little bit for a moment, I was wondering what size staff you had to roughly how many maids and how many cooks and so forth. At least in the early days.
Yes, in the early days. Mm-hmm. In the early days, they had about 6 maids who would take care of the rooms and take care of the lounges. And we had a maintenance man and generally a man who took care of all the community bathrooms because the maids took care of the private bathrooms. We had a night man who was on all night because the doors were locked at night and if people didn't have a key, they'd have to be let in.
Did the people who lived there regularly have their own keys?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we had a cook and a second cook and a pastry woman and a salad person and an extra all-around person. Had 2 or 3 dishwashers, bus boys, and waiters or waitresses, and they were mostly university people. I would say there were probably on our call 20 to 30 dining room people, kitchen people, I mean students who would work. When I came there, they were working for like about 20, 25 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I came down there to work, I was getting $50 a month, and that was in 1933, as a full-time person. Then we had a manager and a bookkeeper and a receptionist at the desk who did a lot of other work, as I just said. And our desk was manned from 7 in the morning until 12 at night. And when the full-time person was not there, it was manned by students, mostly boys. They didn't have too many girls waiting on tables because the trays were heavy and they had to carry them up a flight of stairs. They had a dumb waiter in there, but it never worked. So it wasn't being used very much. And that was a big job because all the dishes had to be, food had to be taken upstairs and carried down, and because the dishwasher was in the kitchen area in the lower level too. I think that's about all of the employees that we had. But there were a great many. I would say all told there must have been between 50 and 60 at least of students and cooks and maids and janitors.
Some full-time, some part-time?
The cooks were, and maids, and janitors were all full-time. The students were part-time.
Mm-hmm.
All the students, whether they were working in the kitchen, whether they were working in the dining room or at the desk, they were all part-time.
How was this sizable staff managed?
It was managed by a manager. They had a manager who was the overall manager. They had a dietitian or a head person down in the kitchen who took care of her department. And the
manager. Planned meals?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And generally in cooperation with the manager. I can remember one time, about one of the first days I had ever been there, and we had a woman manager, and she and the bookkeeper, who was also a woman, and I would frequently eat in the dining room, in the back end of the dining room. And one time they served a spinach souffle. Now this was in the early 1930s when spinach...